I'm Dave Ferguson. I chair the department called Technology and Society in the College of Engineering and Applied Sciences here. And my role here is to try to get things moving and introduce the feature presentation. So there are four presenters in this session, and the first presenter will be Emily Gobeski. She's an instructional librarian at Long Island University, Brooklyn, co-editor of Critical Literary Instruction Theories and Methods. Dr. just this past March from Library Juice Press. And
It's a real book.
That's real, okay. And you're on the editorial board of Radical Teacher, a Journal of Socialist, Feminist, and Anti-Racist Pedagogy. Well, I can already see with the lead-in into this session, it's going to be an interesting session. So, Emily.
All right, thanks. Okay, so I'm going to talk today about using the library catalog as a way of teaching students about class. I'll try to be interesting, but I'm going to read from my paper. So the structures of social and economic class are notoriously difficult for students to see, laboring as they do under the powerful myth that America is a country of endless opportunity, where anyone can triumph over obstacles and do anything that they want to see. This is the rhetoric we hear emanating everywhere from American Idol, or So You Think You Can Dance, which I guess is the summer replacement for that show, for the presidency of the United States. It is a powerful story. Buckle down, and you can do anything you set your mind to. It's not silly, this belief. I think there are strong affective reasons that we cling to that desire, you know, that myth. But I think what's missing is a critical understanding of the way that systems of race, gender, sexuality, ability, and disability, national status, etc., organize, make available, and limit opportunity for all of us. Economic class is one of these systems, and perhaps among the most invisible. Its invisibility means something that fancy requires. Texts and techniques that can reorient students to the existence of class systems and structures are therefore useful for instructors who want to help students develop more critical understandings of their world. So I'd like to suggest that library classification structures function as just such a text. Like class structures, they're often invisible. Like class structures, they're often invisible, but they have strong impact on what is possible to accomplish within them. So I'd like to talk about library classification structures from two perspectives. First, as useful analogy for rendering other invisible structures visible, and second, as themselves structured by and perhaps structuring of economic class. I've been reading a lot of Plato recently for another project, so really compelled by his use of analogy of concrete things to explain abstract things. So hopefully you'll find that even useful. So using classification structures as text in these ways offers librarian instructors, which is what I am, a way to help students understand that other structures are also at work in our social, economic, and political lives, even if we cannot always see them. So first, the analogy. Library classification structures are controlling, unwieldy, and difficult to manipulate. They require that every book have a place in just one place, not only on a physical library shelf, but also in a hierarchical intellectual scheme built on Aristotelian dualities that depend on the constant reification of binary categories. That's a mouthful. An example, a book about lesbian history will be classed under the heading lesbian, which is a sexuality heading, which is grouped in social problems, and this reduces lesbian to a sexual category, reifying it as the marked sexual identity category, whereas books about heterosexuality are simply classified under the heading of family. Like, if you want to go to the library and want to look for a book about heterosexuality, you can't, because it's not named. Which I think is like parallel to our experience of the world that's really obvious, because you do a search and you get nothing. But there's nothing about space. Anyway, so the words that we use to describe these books in the library are drawn from a single list that is biased towards, as librarian activist Sandy Byrne says, librarians do have activists, which I think people maybe don't always know. But he describes library class subject heading schemes as parochial, jingoistic, European, North American, white-hued, he says, I would just say white, at least nominally Christian and preferably Protestant faith, comfortably situated in the middle and higher income brackets, largely domiciled in suburbia, fundamentally loyal to the established order, and heavily imbued with the transcendent, incomparable glory of Western civilization. There's big literature about those subject headings, and it's true. Simple spelling errors or the inclusion of an initial article in a book title can gum up the entire works. So how much harder is the library system to so many other systems for people who are non-native speakers of Spanish English? But all of this drama that I'm describing is hidden behind our library search interfaces, which are increasingly designed to resemble Google, that gift and curse of the beginning academic researcher. We beckon users to our libraries with a promise not unlike that of the American dream. In this library, you can find anything. While this is technically true, interlibrary loan, that unsung triumph of socialism and our capitalist myths, can fulfill pretty much all of your biblio dreams, but success requires an intimate understanding of the structures that run silently underneath our seductively simple keyword box, determining what your search will and won't turn up. So as a library instructor, one of my biggest challenges is teaching students that library research, unlike Googling things, requires an understanding of technical structural apparatuses like call numbers and library of Congress subject headings. A student wanting to know whether LeBron is leading Chicago Bulls or New York Knicks can just Google that. But a student wanting to research the Knicks in a library catalog would want to know that books about basketball are shelved at GB885. The subject heading is New York Knickerbockers Basketball Team. Throwing a random string of words like New York Knicks basketball team history into a library catalog might turn up something, but it also might not. Whereas in Google, it would be good enough. I think the parallel here is fairly clear. Even when it looks like the structure isn't in place, there usually is one. Run into trouble and you think it's you, it's not you, it's that the structure requires understanding. And even Google, which feels simple and like it's working, relies on structures to generate search results, in their case using complex algorithms that I can probably never understand even if I could see them. And this is something else that I find personally interesting, that Google structures are these privatized algorithms that we can never see, whereas library structures, we can all read them. I can show you the books. There are 10, you know, sort of 10 volumes that I've read books, and it's my job to teach you how to use them. Whereas with internet research, those structures are private, corporatized. So like class, library classification structures undergird the culture that seeks to hide them. Unlike class structures, though, library structures are explicitly taught by library instructors like me, in service to middle state accreditation standards and in line with many institutions' mission statements and strategic plans, and they're material things. It's my job to make those structures apparent to students, and I suggest that as we teach these systems in our library classrooms, that we use the opportunity to remind our users that structures are everywhere, and that even when we don't know that we're working within them, they're having a big impact on how we can inhabit our world. So, if classification structures illuminate the existence of class structures in the first place, reading representations of class in the classification can help us understand the ways unarticulated class ideologies confuse every aspect of how we think about and engage with our world. The classification system reflects ruling ideologies in ways that hold a mirror back up to the culture that is cataloged, allowing users to see not only how books are organized in a given library, but according to what overarching set of assumptions about the way the world works. For example, we might suggest that the American dream relies on understanding poverty as an individual problem. The result of poor choices are not working hard enough in school. When we see that books about poverty are shelved as social problems, often far away from books about economic policy, electoral politics, history, racial discrimination, sexism, globalization, on and on, any of the larger structures that organize our economic lives, we can see that the classification reflects some of the basic assumptions of the American dream. Poverty is a problem, for example, it's in social problems, rather than a fundamental requirement of the operation of capitalism. So the physical arrangement of the books on the shelf makes the case for the problem. You can read it really clearly. And if we think about the classification as a text, we can talk to our students about ways to read it critically, grappling with the implications of the arrangement. This bears, I think, a closer look. Library materials are arranged according to classification structures that determine where individual titles are placed on library shelves, as well as their relation to other materials. Generally, public and elementary and secondary libraries are classified according to the decimal system, while college and university libraries are arranged according to library concepts. The classification functions as a kind of scaffolding, an abstract map that generates the physical layout of the library. So books about class are located in class H, the category for social sciences. This broad class is divided into 16 narrower classes called subclasses. Subclass B contains books related to economic theory and demography. Subclass HC contains economic history and conditions and so on. Books about class delineations are housed in class HT, which is community of classes and races. I hope this isn't boring. There's something about librarians talking to people this week. That's not happening. Initially, these divisions appear objective, and I think we treat them as their objective. Books about class can certainly be subsumed under the broader category for social sciences, pairing class and race. And the same subclass makes some kind of sense. They both have impact on the way that social life is organized. But Still, a closer analysis reveals the problems with this arrangement, problems that are reflected in the lived realities of class. For example, LC places books about class in HT. Book class is on either side of this, so we're looking at the library shelf. So here's class HT, our HS, society, secret, benevolent, etc., and HB, social pathology, social and public welfare, knowledge. Books about class then are most prominently related in this classification scheme to social pathology and secret societies rather than economic theory in HB, commerce, HF, or public finance, HJ. Used as a teaching text, LC can helpfully demonstrate that a class in the U.S. is often thought of as something malleably related to the individual rather than causally related to economic theory or public financing, not to mention the even further obscured relationship between class and politics, which is a J, or a class and the law, law being class K. So perhaps the challenge where class shows up in the LC is where it doesn't, is invisibility on the parts of the classification scheme parallel its invisibility in the social world. An articulation of these silences can help students understand class as something operating even when we don't see it. So subclass HT contains books that are explicitly about class. For example, Larry Bartell's recent Unequal Democracy is in HT because it explicitly addresses the question of class in America. A book like Developer, however, is class many shelves even floors away, and yes, even libraries away on some bigger university campuses, where it is shelved along with other books that address the topic of the intellect. To me, it seems just wild, right? Maybe not with these walking, I think it's wild. In literature, long the place where stories of American exceptionalism take the clearest shape is shelved in PS, which is another library world altogether. So, my experience teaching libraries both in a variety of classes. I worked at Sarah Lawrence College, a private elite liberal arts college, and now I work at Long Island University's Brooklyn campus, which is an entirely different student population. Treating the LC structure as a text to be critically engaged rather than simply accepted and regurgitated is compelling to students. They can see quite clearly that structures they didn't know existed have a lot of influence on what they can discover in the library. And it's interesting to note some of these strange conjunctions and disjunctions. The students usually express a flash of recognition, a kind of, that can't be right. The idea that the structures in the library sustain mythologies isn't something that needs to be explained to resistant students. Feel like you try to explain their class operating, but not in my life. It can be demonstrated materially by holding up two books that would seem to have something to do with each other but are often kept far apart. So critical teaching is essentially about helping students ask and then answer the question, could the world be different? How? We must first teach them how things are. And I think the library is a good place in any student can.
And in the sessions, I don't know how things have operated in previous sessions. Do you have comments and questions after the speaker, or do you do it at the end?
At the end.
Okay.
If people want to do it the other way,
you don't want to know. Okay. Next presenter is Anthony Tamburino, and he did his graduate work in sociology of education at Ontario Institute. Research there focused on class inequality in schooling, the streaming of working class students into community colleges, and the hidden curriculum in post-secondary education, which prepares students from different class backgrounds for different sets of social relations that reflect the mental manual division of labor. As of January of this year, he's an assistant professor at the Institute for Labor Studies and Research at West Virginia University, the university's extension program. And he's currently working on organizing the Labor History Week Coalition in West Virginia to promote activities celebrating the first annual Labor History Week in that state. And I guess that's a good one.
I didn't know they were going to read all that. what I want to do is break it down into three questions that I want to ask. And one is, what is the first Labor History Week in West Virginia? Let me start by asking, has anyone heard of Labor History Week in West Virginia? I'd be really surprised if anyone put their hand up. Most people there in the labor movement haven't heard of it either. I'm going to tell you, speak for a minute or two what that is, what the Labor History Week Committee is, and I think at this conference, we're a little more interested in theoretical questions than maybe, unfortunately, the labor movement. I want to spend the bulk of it talking about why I think setting up these Labor History Weeks are really, really important. The left in general. So, West Virginia Labor History, when I just came there a couple of months ago, there was a lot of people putting work into having an official Labor History Week passed, and everyone there told me it'd be a great idea, but we know it's not going to be passed. And much to everyone's surprise, in March, it was quietly passed as a resolution, House Committee Resolution 58, to officially acknowledge Labor History Week the first week of September after Labor Day. But of course, it didn't come out in a big way. No one really even knows about it at all. So myself and a few other people, and it encourages the bill we tried to get passed would make it officially recognizing it would have to be taught in the schools and this. So they watered it down, and the wording is it encourages teachers and schools to address labor history, universities, et cetera, et cetera. And generally, the thought is because it's not mandated, if no one does anything, it's just going to sit there and no one will even know it exists. So a few of us got together and thought, we better hurry up and set something up to promote this and make use of it while it's still there. And my research, and I asked people another question, I tried looking up how many states, and I'm new to the U.S. too, so I'm a little bit feeling my way around, how many other states have labor history weeks. Wisconsin recently had it passed, and it's really hard to find this information out, by the way. Tennessee, believe it or not, has it, and Maryland has put it up, and it looks like it may come through. And I just found out at the UALE conference, California's had it for a while, and they seem to be doing a lot of good stuff there. Does anyone know of any other states that I don't know of that has a labor history week? So it's like two or three states in the whole country even acknowledge labor. We also, I should say, in West Virginia, we had a labor history committee, labor history curriculum set up in the schools about 10 or 15 years ago, and apparently just went nowhere, and they're sitting in boxes in our basement, and they were never used and all this type of thing. So perhaps being the new guy, I'm a little bit more enthusiastic, I wanted to get something up and running to get this going and using this kind of as a springboard. So we set up, or we're in the process of setting up, a West Virginia Labor History Committee or Coalition. Again, we're just trying to do it. Basically where I work, our bread and butter is working with the AFL. And so we put it to them, they're supportive of it, they promoted it on their listserv. The very minuscule West Virginia Labor History Association we contacted, but they're very small. And a few others, and we're actually launching in a week from now at the AFL in Charleston. We put the call out, try to bring as many union people, progressive people, and try to get this popularized. And part of my talk is the idea of popularizing labor history, meaning not just in the schools and not just unions, but try to get this up in the years to come so this becomes a popular thing. We contacted the Pennsylvania Labor History Society about a week and a half ago. We got about 10 people from West Virginia to go on a labor history tour of the Battle of Homestead and all this type of thing. Not very many people showed, in the whole state only 10 showed, but the people that came were very enthusiastic. Although they were retired union workers and this type of thing. But it's something up and running. A whole set of ideas and activities that we'd like to do. I'm going to be speaking at the AFT convention in about 2 weeks and trying to get teachers on board, give them ideas how we can get it up and down. We want to do a Labor History Week festival, music, do pamphlets and all this type of thing, maybe even take out ads as we get up and running. And the idea, again, is popularizing this, and not just in schools. It's kind of a dry period, how it's usually taught 5 minutes in U.S. history. There was this point where these factory workers struggled. But make this popular and relevant to people in different ways. And I don't know how much people know about West Virginia labor history. As I came there, some of the greatest armed battles in U.S. history since the Civil War happened there, where workers literally took up arms. How many people, I'm from Canada, so a lot of this is new. How many people are familiar vaguely with West Virginia labor history? Good number of people. So fighting the army over union rights, company towns where the owner of the mine literally owned everything and you worked for them. But we had a very radical labor history, which I'm still excited about as I come there. Socialist Party used to run towns, they won every seat in some places. The IWW was big, the workers talk in very socialist language only 70 or 80 years ago. And the ruling class in the military was very brutal, just slaughtered many, many, many people. So for me, coming in, there's a lot of ground to stand on to talk to people that can really show, if you talk to labor history, to really show the naked realities of how the system works in ways that are more difficult from where I come in Toronto, which is kind of a yucky town. Again, my sense, no one wants to have, you don't call anyone working class in Toronto, right? None of us can know. My experience, it seems, in West Virginia, is they consider themselves, they may not say working class, but they say working men and stuff like this. There's still an underlying sense that they're a colonized place, that they're abused, that their resources are exploited from outside interests, which I think is a progressive thing in the fact of the consciousness. You can work with that. And you can do a lot of things as well. If labor history is done properly, I think it could be linking, you could do a lot of criticism of the here and now in ways that you couldn't get away with. If I just taught a high school class and taught them how corporations own everything and this, you know, there could be trouble. But you can do it properly in a way that people, especially in that state, can easily come to their own conclusions that nothing much seems to change. You may have heard of the Big Mine disaster a little while ago. People there, union people I talked to, see nothing's changed in 100 years. We're fighting the same battles. So I'm viewing the opportunity to teach labor history to be very you can do a subversive, radical critique of the here and now without being explicit about it, right? Without having parents complaining or whatever other things that might happen to you. Well, this is a very real thing. You know, in Arizona, they're passing legislation where teachers cannot say that there's social differences and that people are oppressed. I mean, in the 1950s are lingering there, and you have to be cognizant. So I think the last part, why we need a popular labor history, and this is to me the meaning. Can you give me the time on the 10-minute mark? I think there's an objectively growing need for labor history right now more than any time ever, and I really think this should be taken up as a major thing we should be doing. And why is that? One of them, a few of the meetings I mentioned today. If you look at social class as a set of relations, instead of what most people think, you know, there used to be a lot of factory workers and robber barons. We don't work in factories anymore, therefore we're not working class. If you look at it as a set of relations, that one class doesn't own anything, has to work for others that do, and all this type of thing, the working class is growing. If you look 100 years ago, the working class was maybe 30% of the population. Americans were largely, you know, these from petty bourgeois. They were small farmers and a small section of workers. Today, you don't have that small independent farmer class anymore. It's becoming almost literally, you either own wealth and you control it, you live off it, or you don't, you work for people that do. So the increase of the service sector, the retail sector, means more people have been, again, using the term proletarianized, stripped of ownership and control over land and over this. So we now have 70% of the population are workers compared to 30% at the peak of the labor movement. So we need to teach people that they belong to a class of workers, I would suggest. And labor history is a way we can do it in a subversive way without coming up and saying that. So the working class is expanding and not disappearing. And if you look at the growth industries, call centers, service centers, fast food, the conditions are very similar, and hopefully more students would see this. If you look at factory work in slaughterhouses in 1910, and then you look at call centers where students work, they should be able to say, see, I have a manager who walks up and down the roads and times us that we have 3.5 minutes on each call and this type of thing. So this subversive critique is implicit if done properly. Why else? There's been, as many people have said at this conference, there's an extreme right-wing offensive on the working class as a whole. And if anyone heard Fletcher this morning, I mean, he pointed out the pink elephant in the middle of the room that a lot of people don't notice. And he said, I think I can quote, we're getting our ass kicked. We're being beaten badly. We have to do something now. And I think that's definitely the case. These attacks are strategic and systematic on working people. As many people have said at this conference, living standards are being pushed down. The far right is on offensive for about 25 years. We now have one of the biggest and continuously growing gaps between rich and poor. When you talk to West Virginians, and hopefully other people I know work in places where there's similarities, and you teach them what it was like in 1920 and 1930, it's worse now. You have fewer people owning more and more. So it's very relevant. Union density now, and let me ask people, do you know what the peak percent of union density, how many percentage of workers were involved in unions? Do you know what the peak in U.S. history was, what decade and roughly how much it was? Let me ask anyone.
In the 50s, it was about 30%.
So in the 1950s, you had the most unionized percentage of the workforce unionized, the third.
Yeah.
And does anyone else know what it is now?
12%, 8%
for private sector, 13% for public sector. No, it's just the private sector's total. Seven.
Really?
Yeah.
Put
it
together is about 12, right?
Yeah. 11, I think 11%
total for private
sector. Okay. So from 30% in about a generation of 2000, 11 or 12. The magic number, so to speak, in all the literature I've read is 10%. That once unionization goes 10% or below, you're no longer a relevant force in that country. So we are teetering on the force of the only form of organization workers have in this country, which is unionization, I would say in the next 5 to 10 years, withering away, becoming almost extinct. So I would suggest not to sound alarmist, but let's be alarmist. We have to get moving, and we can't just rely on this. And I would say talking about labor history gives us that opportunity. And just really quickly, and a lot of other Western and North European countries, people know what general, what the union density rate is in comparison to our 11 or 12% here. In many Scandinavian countries, 50, 60, 70%. I think Canada's around 40. The U.S. is the lowest in all of these, one of the lowest in all of these countries, which is shocking if you haven't heard this before. All these new excessive restrictions being placed on labor unions, the employing class, I would suggest, and you could do this inexplicitly by teaching labor history, I would suggest is one of the most class-conscious, most aggressive, most unified ruling class in the world. They know, all the workers in America, all the studies that I've seen have amongst the lowest forms of class consciousness compared to Europe. The ruling class here is very, very conscious of themselves. And they know that they have different interests. And they strategically are attacking what they see as the most successful form, the last form of working class organization in the U.S. unions. They destroy the left-wing party, the Socialist Party, the Communist Party, the Working Men's Party, all these parties that were fairly strong at one point. They destroy the labor newspapers that used to be around. In fact, if you read Noam Chomsky or Michael Parenti, 100 years ago, left-wing labor newspapers had wider circulations than the mainstream newspapers. Now they're just about off the map compared to other countries. There's no alternative. So the right wing has the media. They have Fox News, CNN. They have all these things. They have two political parties at their backing. What they're doing in Texas, you know, to the schools, you had this little moment history in the U.S. where you had some fairly progressive things recognized in the curriculum, that's being driven out. So no mention of Cesar Chavez, no mention of unions, no mention of robber barons, and this type of thing. So I will suggest, and another thing about labor unions, it's an objective fact, not open for debate, that belonging to a union improves the living standards of a worker. You make more money, you get more time off, you're less likely to be injured, it's better for workers, and that's objective. Okay. 10 minutes. Okay. I thought you were saying, don't say that. <We're> there. So this is objective, but as you may or may not know, recent studies, about half the American population thinks unions are bad, and roughly half are good. And again, you know, half, that could be a good thing, at least half of them, despite all this propaganda. Here's what I think. Daily barrage of anti-union propaganda, but still one in every two people know that a union is better than not. But the other side of me says, we can convince half the population that the most obviously beneficial thing they have to bring it back. So we really have to come back to this. And I'm talking about popularizing. I think we have to go out to non-unionized people and tell them what unions are about, what they do for people. Because the only people who hear anything positive about unions is that 10% who are in unions. And a lot of them won't even hear that much. When I teach in West Virginia, I can't believe how little often they've been taught in their own unions about these things. So I think this is something that needs to be done. There's a battle of ideas that's been going on that's being won, I would say, by the far right. They're convincing people to look at the world in this individualistic, look out for yourself type of ethos. At the same time, you're destroying the last remaining vestige of working class organization. On the positive note, though, many studies suggest that people still hold some progressive ideas despite all this. And you may have recently heard, I'm not sure if to make of this study, that was done that something like 40% of Americans, when they hear the word capitalism, have negative connotations, and something like 35% have positive connotations with socialism. I'm not sure that they know what those terms exactly mean, but there's some sort of general idea that capitalism is about rich people screwing us. Some general idea that socialism is about the government should help us and we should work together. I think that's their idea. They still put positive connotation in terms of progressive and all this type of thing. So this is something that needs to be built on. Because part of this attack on labor is not just on workers' right to bargain and have some input to their work. I would say it's also an attack on the idea that classes exist in the United States. That working people have different lives and have different conditions and different roles than people who own everything. So if they can drive that idea out of people's heads and just continue with this murky, we're all middle class, all Americans on the same side against China and Mexico, they're going to really push us down. So I think it's important to get these ideas out. And as well, I have been having some informal discussions with people. Again, I'm the outsider that's new here, so sometimes I'm overly optimistic about things. The rich legacy and heritage that U.S. working class half of their labor history. We cannot let this be whitewashed. It's a proud, rich heritage that people recognize around the world. And people know what May Day is. Every country virtually in the world celebrates this, but here, its origins were in the United States. The 1st of May, International Workers Day, where workers around the world celebrate the rights we won. It's been pushed out of the consciousness of U.S. Workers. International Women's Day, again, celebrated everywhere, started here. Every union around the world, seeing solidarity forever, that came from here. We used to have a tradition of labor and left summer camps where you take your kids and you would do swimming and soccer picnics, but teach them progressive ideas. The Worker Olympics, I believe, started here. Has anyone heard of the Worker Olympics that used to happen? Not very many people. It went against the mainstream Olympics, which was country versus country. This was workers working together. Housing co-ops, where people owned their apartments and didn't have to pay rent to other people. The idea of libraries were started in the left and labor movement. The idea that books and ideas shouldn't be preserved of rich people who have their own libraries. Public eateries, all these things were part of U.S. working class history, and they inspired me to come here. To try to build on that, to try to stand on the shoulders of giants, and not let those ideas fade away from history. And I think, in my experience, when I talk to West Virginian workers and you tell them this, they definitely, their eyes don't gloss over, they don't yawn, they move ahead and they say, I can't believe this, I never knew that. And it seems to me, when I start talking to them, they have a lot of conservative ideas floating around, but it seems to be a mile, what's the expression, a mile long, but an inch deep. A little bit of probing, not even talking about today, talking about what they used to do, and suddenly they turn from, you know, anti-immigrant, pro-war, and all this type of stuff to, you know, why do we even need employers at all? Can't we run this alone? So I think getting labor history out gives us this kind of opportunity. How much time? 2 minutes, okay. As well, it also has the opportunity to to blow the idea that the U.S. government and ruling class is a peaceful, democratic institution. When you look at the U.S. labor history, it's one of the bloodiest and most violent in the world. And workers were killed in big numbers, beyond being killed in mines and all this stuff, killed by the police and the military, more so than other countries. And the other part of that is it blows to bits the myth that workers are passive, conservative sheep that just do whatever they're told. Because these were largely immigrant workers that had no formal education, that started these organizations, that gave their lives to fight for things like the 8-hour day and all this type of thing. And I think this inspires people. And I think it's something you can build on. And by being able to talk to people about this, I think that gives us a leg up and gives us more room to talk and maneuver about how things are today. So the idea of reclaiming the battle of history from below and speaking to the collective democratic impulses and traditions of working class people in this country is something that I think could be done in labor history weeks. And I would like to start floating the ideas, if I can get it up and going in West Virginia, to try to get some sort of in the future national coordinating labor history weeks of the U.S. or something like this, and get these things done in many states. Anyway, that's where we're at. I'm probably out of time now, so yes. I'll leave it there.
Yes. So, next presenter is Sharon Szymanski, who's been involved in labor education for 20 years. You're 5 years old when you started, right? She has focused on developing popular economics education for working adults at the Labor Institute and as faculty at SUNY, the Empire State College, called SUNY, in New York State. Her most current courses include the economics of healthcare, women, the economy and the trades, the global workplace, and labor and the economy. Oh, you're doing it together. Oh, okay. Now I get it. I noticed that both of you are from SUNY Empire State College. Okay. So, Diane Ramdahl has been an adult education and adult literacy practitioner for over 15 years. Her practice has focused mainly on popular education and finding ways to make space with and for marginalized populations. She's written extensively about democratic practices in adult education. As a faculty member at SUNY Empire State College, New York City, she's currently teaching classes on issues related to class, race, and gender. So it's Sharon and Diane.
The Harry Van Arsdale Jr. Center for Labor Studies in New York City. And what I'm going to do is just give a little bit of the background of who we are, what our program is, the principles that guide our program, and then Diane will actually speak to how the definition of our program, along with the guiding principles, actually defines the kind of pedagogy that we use. Now, the Harry Van Arsdale Jr. Center for Labor Studies is one of 35 centers within Empire State College. And for those of you who don't know the arrangement, Empire State College is devoted to education for working adults. And Empire State College is one of the 13 colleges within the SUNY system, State University of New York, just situated. And our particular program started about 30, 35 years ago with Harry Van Arsdale, who was the president of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, IBEW Local 3, mandated that in order for electrician apprentices to become card-carrying journeymen, that they needed the minimum of an associate's degree. So our program supplies for hopefully Kentucky's people to get the minimum of an associate's degree. However, we also offer bachelor's and master's degrees. Just bachelor's. We have about 1,200 students, and they're primarily electrician apprentices, but we also have a small group of plumbers and painters, carpenters, and paraprofessional teachers. What's unique to our program is the apprentices, who have a five-year apprenticeship program, work all day, and they take electrical theory classes one night a week, and then they take a college-level course with us another night a week. So it's a very grueling schedule, as you can imagine. And attendance in the college-level courses is a condition of their employment. So if they miss four classes, they're out of their job, which, of course, is very serious, because in order to become an apprentice, you can wait up to 2 years to get in the program, plus it's one of the highest-paying trades that there is. So the attendance policy is quite serious. So you can imagine that for some students, this particular policy is seen as very punitive and unrelated to what they do. So our challenge as instructors is how, in fact, do we engage students, many of whom do not want to be there because they do not see it as relevant to their jobs. After all, they decided to go into the trades because they did not want to be in school. So that is one of our biggest challenges, and in effect, has bearing on the kind of pedagogy that we can try to use. Now, the principles that guide our program. Our orientation literature asks our students two questions. Why do trade unionists need to go to college? And why does the labor movement need to go to college? Now, the answer that we put forth suggests three reasons. The first two are kind of no-brainers. One, education obviously enhances your job and career opportunities. And two, education provides opportunities for enriching oneself. And third, that we like to think that we stress perhaps more than any other, is that the union movement needs well-educated members and leaders in order to know what questions need to be asked, what in fact, how to understand the questions, and then to be able to articulate the questions and the ramifications such that all working people get their fair share. Okay. Now, although our students are all trade union members, many of them have no sense of awareness of the larger role that unions have played in our society. For many of our students, they wanted to become electricians because, after all, it means good benefits and a good pension. So what we try to do in our curriculum, and remember, we're constrained by SUNY guidelines, for one thing, is to provide educational opportunities whereby we can explore the ideas that trade unions go beyond good pay and benefits, and that, in fact, trade unions are social institutions that help to shape economic, political, and social policies, and that can contribute to the intellectual and cultural lives of members and communities. We see education, using a particular pedagogy, which Diane will speak about, as essential to political action and to progressive power and action. And if we're very consciously, if we don't structure education in a progressive and humanistic direction, someone or some other political force will come into that void and structure it in another direction. And this is particularly significant when you're in a period, as we are, in a recessionary period. It's kind of ripe for these reactionary notions.
So I'll just read what I have briefly, because I'd like to spend most of the remaining time in conversation with the rest of you. And, So in light of what my colleague Sharon says, it makes sense to me and others within our program to ground our pedagogy in participatory and liberatory practices, which for many of you in this room, I suspect, are not new terms, right? For me, this is meant specifically using problem posing as opposed to problem solving principles to frame issues in the classes I teach. This approach asks, rather invites students to believe in themselves as knowledge producers instead of knowledge consumers. So one of the basic tenets of liberatory practice is that education isn't value free, but embedded in a larger social context. This methodology supports people in seeing social connections and analyzing larger systemic inequities, rather than blaming people for having difficulty in pulling themselves up by their bootstraps or making it right, which, well, it's a longer conversation, but this is why I read, because it invites students to promote action outside the classroom by collectively transforming the space inside the classroom. By subverting traditional classroom roles, students are able to re-examine their identities outside of class, ultimately with the goal and possibility of working towards more egalitarian, humane structures and a larger sort of democratic society. Within my current context, one activity that I ask students to engage in is collectively writing a short skit that embodies an issue they're grappling with at work. Usually this happens when we're reading the text, "We'll Call You If We Need You," which is this book. Many of you might know this. It's a book of oral histories by women working in construction. So students write a short skit kind of encapsulating the issue and just the issue, right? That they're kind of struggling with. Each group might read their issue to the larger class, and their classmates kind of describe what's happening, why it's happening, and what can be changed, how the situation can be changed. So there's chance for action, analysis, and description. Groups then can act out different endings. And there's a way in which the space in the classroom provides an option to rehearse and envision different endings, and the beginnings of transformative education is sort of, it becomes a visible and viable path moving forward. Change, educational and social, it's ongoing, right? It's difficult. We've talked about the different ways in which it's difficult here. And inviting students, and inviting us in this room, inviting people, right, to reconceptualize roles and identities is difficult and demands sort of sustainable time and continuous commitment. And to me, problem posing offers us a space to grapple with larger problems, their causes, but also provide space for dreams and ideals that people hold in their hearts for themselves, their communities, their families, and the world. And I think it offers us a different way of perhaps living in the world and being with each other. And most of this has been inspired by, for me, by Paul Burry and Abbas de Boal, who, I worked in literacy, and in literacy, we, adult literacy, we very much sort of use a lot of those techniques. And it so happened that it came to me to make sense to continue doing that in this new position. I mean, so some ethical dichotomies we kind of grapple with at the center in an everyday way. How can liberatory educational principles be enacted in what essentially is a mandatory educational project, right? How can we support consistency between the mandatory philosophy of our program and translating that into liberatory pedagogy in a consistent way that relies heavily on agile teaching? If democratic practice is about the everyday details, how can we engage, how can we at the center and, you know, faculty and staff engage in a sustained struggle when we're located in a higher education context that privileges individualism and competition? And how can we structure classes so that rigor or what is traditionally defined as rigor isn't sacrificed, but that students have access points to enter the conversation in meaningful ways, and that they're not left behind in this process, right? Because that's sort of perpetuating what happens to the rest of faculty. And these are learning questions that we struggle with, and clearly we don't have the answers to. I thought we could maybe start a conversation.
Maybe we could have everybody turn and.
Yes. Or we could just move back to our seats.
Well, here at this university in front of me. And I had a couple of thoughts for Anthony. I winced when I saw like Union Space, the disruption or what was the term. And since you're not from Long Island, I just want to share with you that this area is actually quite strong. The labor movement is pretty strong here. It's actually the fifth most dense union area in the country. We have a 250,000 union members here. So the presiding officer of the county legislature, the former IBEW president. So there are some bastions of strength on the share that too. I asked the question, how did I was reading the Times and everything about the changes to the textbooks in Texas. I just wanted to throw that out for comment. I'm sure you guys have tons of thoughts. And another thought that I was thinking was, when I went to high school here on Long Island, I read some labor history, but I didn't make the connection that this stuff is still relevant now. And I was curious about how that's ensured. I mean, that was the point of doing this, to show them that there's we still have these labor problems, like class war is still going on strong. But how can you just talk more about how students will walk away from that labor history with that sense of that this class war is still going on that part?
Well, that's a tough one. All the high school labor history stuff I've seen or documentaries on television, step forward and step back, because it's taught in such a way, I think it was intended that you'd be able to say that was one period and one point that no longer relevant. And they tend to focus on the idea of working class means factory workers. You have the robber baron image of individual who own things versus the corporation. And all this legislation was passed, and we no longer have that. And that's kind of, so even though it's alluded to, it's taught in a way to teach you that it's no longer an issue. And it's difficult not to do it that way, but I think if you focus on things, and for me, I like to put myself in that camp that doesn't see labor history as a history of organizations over labor, but working class history, and talking about what it means to be working class. It doesn't just mean factory workers in the 1930s. Shoveling coal or working in the mountains. The people that don't own the place they work in, that don't control it, that work for other people and they produce things that they don't control, as opposed to 100 years ago, artisans who controlled it. So if you can somehow put that across, so that just because people aren't necessarily working factories, and make the links, and I think this is the, labor education techniques, I mean, they're really hard to do, but when I struggle. But ask the, because part of doing that is asking questions, a lot of really good questions, like taking 3 weeks to come up with I'm doing a collective bargaining course when I get back. And I spent months putting this thing together. I wrangled for days on end, rewording a question. Just emphasize this, do this, and come up with good questions. But the idea is how are conditions similar and different? But people working, the average teenager is going to be looking forward to a life working in Walmart or service sector or working in offices. Like so many women are going to work in offices, which they probably think compared to these factory workers in the 30s, you wear nice clothes, it's air conditioning, the boss calls us by our first name, all that stuff. But the reality is they're facing a lot of broader conditions that are very similar to what people were facing 80 years ago. So to make those links is a challenge. And again, I don't want to keep beating this point, but we're under attack, and we're under a microscope, and you have to be kind of careful in how you present this. Right? The legacy of McCarthyism still exists. So that's the techniques we have to develop, and I'd like to one day see a National Labor History Week committee where people, we can have our own organization to discuss how we can do these things. But the sweatshop issue, too, sweatshops are growing all over the U.S., underground type things, and take-home work, and Unite unions are often working similar trades than they were 100 years ago. So that's the challenge. How do you do this that people come away saying that a lot of these conditions are similar, or that we went backwards now in consensus? And unions are still relevant. If you can ask the question, why do workers start unions in the first place? Hopefully, if you do it well, you can say, are these still relevant today? And come to those conclusions. And hopefully, most people will see it. If you didn't pocket red, even if there's someone sitting there like this, and no, there's bound to be someone to take that up. So, I don't know if you'd like to.
middle of one of the speakers, so I ran out.
So I'm sorry that I missed part of the presentation. I work part-time at a community college, but I also work part-time with Mexican workers, providing adult education, like GED classes in their own language. And I think I can address it to all in regards to labor history, but I was particularly interested in the problem-solving strategy that you had, Diane, shared and talked about. For me, I'm so, I have a question of abstraction. So could you give me an example? What would be an example of something that's problem-posing where, like, maybe you found successful with your students? Like, I'm just thinking about the whole field or something, but just, like, one example would be really fantastic.
Well, I think that the important thing is that the problem has to come from the group, right? And so it's not, wouldn't be our naming an issue, but doing a lot of listening and asking of questions, right? And so so part of the goal of writing a skit, of collectively writing a short skit, is that students come up with an issue that they, that sort of reflects their everyday lived realities on their job site, right?
So can you give an example of what has been posed?
This is really sort of painful for me to say, but I will. We've read this book together, right, which is a book about women construction workers. And the women in the class, I taught this particular class to once, and they've internalized this notion of male imposed. Sexuality notions, right? So the skit actually involves how slutty women were being on the work site. And this was written by a woman, right? And so so that was just one issue. And sort of like who gets to define whose identity. So that's one question. There are many, but I think the important thing is that the issues that are grappled with come from the group. They have to mean something to the students, but they can't be imposed by the
group. And they also have to put the idea of being late and do some presentation, sorry about that. So, but if you're thinking of your presentation, which I found really fascinating, and one of the questions I have several questions, I see how I can pose them in the clear first. One is the distinction between working class history and labor in the sense of organized labor and union history. Right? I mean, they are two different things. And I say this because it seems to me that it's important to go through this in a reflective way too. And I think that we do need also a critical introspection into the role of unions, and unions cannot always be able to represent all of working class drivers, and they have also been in many ways obstacles in some cases for the renewal of working class consciousness. And so I suppose it's difficult to raise all these issues within certain programs. So I guess my other question is, how do we bring something similar to within unions as a way of looking at ourselves critically and seeing where we have gone wrong? And I mean, we are under attack, and I don't know a lot of labor history in the US, my area is similar, but this is similar process everywhere. But I don't think that, I mean, union was also very badly positioned to respond to some of these, and it was badly positioned because politically we were these problems with labor movements everywhere. So how do we reflect on that critically? How do we use this knowledge and your skills in terms of pedagogy to raise some of these unions with their rank and file and to promote a process of critical reflection on this? I don't know if the question can be answered or make sense, but whether we see that this is also a process that makes sense, that's where obviously we do look at unions, we try to revive in order
doing it in a different way. Not everything was good. Like, I mean, we need to raise those questions.
Well, I guess I think we're very aware of that problematic in terms of the difference between the trade union movement and then, working class organization and the extension of that into, alliances with community groups, whatever other kinds of churches, et cetera. And I think, for example, when I was teaching a class on the economics of healthcare, it was very clear that any of the organizing that was taking place around healthcare was clearly beyond trade union capacity, even though the trade union movement had been involved with it, since the 1915 or something, trying to get universal healthcare. But I think it really helps if you have concrete examples, whether critically or in affirmation of how the union movement has been not only involved in and of itself, but also how it has made alliances outside of the trade union. And it's so clear when you look at specific examples.
I think, too, if I can say a few things. If you do it from a historical perspective, in the U.S., there's really been two souls of unionism. There's been the one that won out, which is the conservative business unionism represented by Congress and Mayor. But before the Second World War, there was this rich radical working class unionism represented by the IWW, people like this. And that's recognized by the whole labor. As I said, I'm working mostly with AFL union, so I always have to be think about how you present this. But two things, my understanding, I started reading Bill Fletcher Jr.'s books, All Air Divided, and from some people I spoke to, it looks like there's more of an opening in the labor movement, that they recognize they have to be more inclusive and recognize, to some extent, racism. And I think AFL unions have now more of a progressive international outlook than they did during the Cold War. So that's one thing, you have a bit of an opening. And the second thing, if you pose them as historical questions, say historically, 80 years ago, you had these two forms of unionism. The IWW, for example, who believed, all workers should be organized, that the system was the problem, and the purposes of unions of the workers' power. And then you have the AFL, who said, let's work together with employers. So you're not directly, I think, attacking them today, but you're doing it historically. And I would think a good section of workers would be enthusiastic about the social unionism. And you can ask, what about today? But a lot of people say this is irrelevant today, what you think. And I think if done strategically, you can, as I said before, you can bring in a critique of things now without actually explicitly doing it. And I would think if they left, I like to show posters, IWW posters. And I remember struggling. I was going to show the famous one, which shows a pyramid. I don't know if you know this poster, and it's in the top. It's got bankers and militarists, and it says, we rule you. Underneath them, there's a bigger group of priests and people like this. We fool you. Anyone seen this?
Yeah.
We rule you.
Priests and teachers, I think.
It's like a four pyramid cake. It's like this. On the top, there's a couple of military, there's a couple of robbers, we rule you, then it's priests, we fool you, then it's police and soldiers, we shoot you, and the bottom one is a bunch of rich, decadent people eating fancy food, and I don't know.
We eat for you.
We eat for you. Oh. And in the back, it's 100 workers holding the pyramid up on their backs, and then it says capitalism. And I kind of wondered, West Virginians are very religious, they're very pro-military, are they going to riot? And I finally showed it, and no one blanked an eye, they're laughing. And I said, here this was produced, and whatever it was like before. They were mocking just like today, and all this type of thing. So I think I helped them do a criticism the way things are without directly doing it. And I'd like to think they walked away with more of a social consciousness. They know what social unionism is now, they know what business unionism is. Without me coming in, which what I would really like to do is come in and say, business unionism is back in this corner. They shook hands with the devil, and the devil laughed, whatever metaphor. and now he's got you in a corner, and you don't have a leg to stand on because you bought into all this we're partners type of. But often, I can't do that. But if you do a historical thing, I think they come away with a message. And again, U.S. labor history to me is an outsider. You've got so much rich material to build upon that can easily be brought up today. And the thing too, with all the anti-immigrant hysteria going on today, some, I don't know how many people at the UALE conference, but a lot of them, I was really impressed. They did this thing with a historical timeline, going back to whenever, with all these anti-Irish cartoons and newspapers, anti-Belgium, you know, today you laugh at anti-Belgium. Can you imagine workers getting upset because people from Belgium? And they go, you know, anti-Chinese and anti-Taiwanese, and they don't explicitly say anything about today. And they say workers see how ridiculous anti-Irish ideas were on this type of stuff. And they started coming up to the idea, well, and these were conservative, they said they didn't even conservative workers. Well, isn't that how we're treating Latino workers and all that stuff? And they start arguing. For me, when I'm teaching, I always smile inside. I get really excited. I do want to leave inside. When people are saying things that I wanted them. But I don't have to. So when I'm there with some worker at the back, since that's how we're treating Mexican workers, say, I don't care. But it's done properly. I mean, I think that's our dream when that situation happens, right? When they're making a criticism.
As a connection.
You have a lot of problems with labor.
I just wanted to say, for those of you who haven't seen Capitalism Blustering, I think it sort of offers a good kind of start for a conversation, a longer conversation making connections in this context. It's Michael Morrissey's. And the other thing I just wanted to I don't know if you, you've read Making Meaning, Making Change by Elsa Auerbach. It's called Making Meaning, Making Change, and I think that that she offers a really, really great access point for popular education in the context you're currently working in. And if you'd like, I'd be happy to give you my contact information. And probably we can continue this conversation.
I just wanted to say, Emily, thank you very, very much for your time. I enjoyed all of them, don't get me wrong. But Emily, in particular, I just wanted to say, the reason being is probably a very personal thing. I spent my years as an undergraduate and postgraduate working at the library to support my studies.
Me too.
And I mean, librarianship, that was like my second choice after academia, and it was really hard road to find academia and librarianship. So when I was shown what's in the life program, I had lots of thoughts about the classification system, and I didn't find it all before I was I'm also instantly familiar with age classification because I've been doing my master's in PhD on Edinburgh. And I've had so many times where I thought, wow, they got that so right, they must have actually read books before they put the research up. But then other times when it's been completely, completely bizarre. But I've never, even though I was doing work on class power structure, all that kind of thing, politics, and having that history of being, librarianship appealed to me because I love books, but also because of all those egalitarian ideas. It just blows me away that I never thought about it in that way before. So, yeah, it's been really good. You've given me a lot to think about.
Yeah, I think we think of them as benevolent, kind.
Well, I was thinking, whenever I thought about it, and I'm honestly, literally, in the spirit of someone new, like when you think about the librarians classified, you think of them, but you think of a team of really lovely librarians thinking very objectively and nicely about it and being really smart about it. All librarians I know, except for that one probably, are really, really cool people. And so it's hard to imagine, maybe it's an emotional reaction, it's just, it seems such a neutral thing, but of course it's not.
Yeah, and I think that librarians, when they classify, or when anybody does any kind of, invisible knowledge of labor, you're being neutral, but your neutrality is historical, right? So you generate these historical remnants of the ideology that was dominant.
jacket on it, you know. But thank you.
Any other?
Oh, yes. Diane, you said there are two authors you mentioned, Abel Pierre, and who was the other?
Auguste Rouen.
Auguste
Rouen, R-E-O-A-L. Yeah, there was just, he just believed that that spectators, the notion of being a spectator, was really the sensitive notion of sort of not being involved in shaping your own reality and not having agency. And so he subverted that by creating this theater where people were spectators. And so there was through a bunch of different strategies that they could come up and change anything, so they were actually involved in the making and shaping of the federal economy.
And I just have a question. One of the things that is interesting about being working in West Virginia is what you described, and this is true, and it's sort of one of the questions, is that West Virginia did have this extraordinary military history based in coal mining, UMW, and all, you know, this major strikes and struggles. And so one of the questions is, what happened to it? And I think that's not rhetorical. I think that one of the things that would be useful for a labor history discussion is, why did people who were in the forefront of working class consciousness, working class struggle up through the 1920s, and the Harlan County in the 1930s, right? So that whole sort of Appalachian coal mining area was sort of seen as a typical sort of archetype of a class struggle, right? How did that become the home of the rival populace? And that becomes a question, saying, your grandparents believed this. You believed that. How did that happen? Because one of the things is that something must have happened in terms of how those ideas were transmitted to kids. Because there's a lot of work on the historical work on the sort of heyday of class struggle, which part of it is they lost, right? I mean, when you talk about the Meiwan strike, was the first time that airplanes were used to attack civilians in world history. It was the U.S. Air Force sent the Air Force against the strikers. So a pattern which unfortunately has been repeated all around the world, but it started in Meiwan, West Virginia. So being defeated made it happen. But whatever happened, somebody now whose great grandfather was in the Meiwan strike in 1921, their grandfather was in the Meiwan strike in 1921, who now votes Republican, believes that we should have prayer in schools, thinks that all of those liberal hippies in the cities are a problem, and votes Republican. How did that happen? Right? And how can that be reversed? And there's some part of ways in which history can, you know, participate in that. I don't think the reactionary nature of certain sections of the American working class is natural. I think it was done to them. I think that has to be incorporated into labor history. I ask the same thing from Indiana, where I work is, you know, there are in the South, there was United Mine Workers. There were first sit-down strike was in South Bend, Indiana, 6 months before Flint. This is very militant working class history, and then it kind of vanishes. And in some ways and it's one of the things I think with labor historians, we get embarrassed about it, and we ignore it, and we're whatever, is the role of McCarthyism on working class culture and how that works. That's, I think, where the break is. That the, you know, up through 1948, 1950, there is this link tradition that there are people in who this is a continuity. You knew people who knew people who were. And when I got to Indiana, people were still talking about their grandparents and doing the Knights of Labor. Right? There's a real continuity of that, and then it stops. And then nobody remembers. And I think that there's a way in which you need to incorporate the defeat into the history in order for them to be a way of reviving it. Because I think that the defeat probably led to the sort of why places like West Virginia and other places, particularly in the South, and Indiana sort of has a large part of the South in it, where people don't remember and purposely don't remember. The best source I found for this is a very interesting film about the 1934 generals, the Texas strike in the South. And what's interesting about it, it's not heroic, it's not like the riot workers rise up and win.
what the documentary shows is going back to interview people 60 years later saying, I can't talk about this because it's too scary. They were beaten so badly that 60 years after the strikes, there's no, we don't talk about that around here. And so that to incorporate that part of the ways that workers were defeated actively then led to certain pathways. It's not a natural conservatism, but it's kind of, what are we going to do? If we speak up, we're going to get shot.
I think if I can add to that as well, and again, coming from a place where militarism is looked at suspiciously and super patriotism is looked at, so I'm still taken aback when I go to union meetings and they start by praying, that's how they start a meeting, and then they literally pledge allegiance to the U.S. And they always start by taking time to salute policemen and soldiers. And this is from a state which is two or three generations ago. They literally, when the police and soldiers came in, people yelled traitors. Apparently in Pennsylvania, they yelled Cossacks, who were the soldiers who protect the Tsar during the Russian Revolution, that these soldiers would get beaten, they'd get kicked out of town, and stuff like this. There were one or two generations where they're almost worshiping the symbols of, like if you go to the West Virginia History Museum, they have the cannons that the soldiers fired on civilians that were wanted a 9-hour day instead of 12-hour and this type of stuff. So it's there, they know it. But, you know, I'm kind of thinking, again, the elephant in the room, how could they not make a connection? And in fact, so that is the big question. But too, I mean, I came early to New York and did the labor that you walked in. And New York is obviously not as conservative as itself, but you have all these left-wing newspapers in New York, their offices are still there, the Italian Labor Center, this center, on the May Day parades at the Union Square in 1945, had tens of thousands of people. So what happened to that, to just a generation or two later, where, you know, the Haymarket Square massacre, and the police were the ones that fired on civilians, and you had in New York tens of thousands of people when Sacco and Vanzetti were about to be executed, and police were the symbols of the guards of the ruling class. And then you have such a radical change so fast in history that it comes to that. So I don't even really know the answer. I think there's a lot of repression that the left seems to always dismiss the parties and the ideological victories of the ruling class, to equate progressivism, collectivism with the embodiment of evil. So I'm not sure the answer, but I think when you do history, you can have that as an open-ended question, so I'm not sure we're going to get a response to that.
Emily, were you going to take that?
No. I have to cop to knowing nothing about labor history, and I just want to ask a question about educating designers. But I also think David Roediger, in the way that he writes about the way that the whiteness writes about this moment, and I think there are all kinds of ways to talk about the moment you all are talking about, as the preservation of white supremacy, right? So if the country to move forward from a particular moment, white laborers had to and were encouraged to, I think, make a choice. And that was either for a certain retention of power or not. And I think that that's not an individual choice. I don't mean it in that way. But I think that part of what goes along with that depth of repression is making a choice toward, even if it's sort of as a generation or as a town, toward something that's not that. And when there is a larger power structure, so I think Roediger talks really interestingly about really the voice of the idea of the wages of whiteness, and how all of that structured and helped to structure these kinds of sets of relationships around choice in a structural sense in the 20s and 30s in particular. So I think that there's also this other sort of huge piece that, I don't know if this is part of what you were alluding to, but this other huge piece of what gets maintained when, I think in particular, labor becomes, you know, corporate on some level, or labor organizing becomes corporate on some level, and to what extent is labor consistent in use in the history of the United States to be the white counterpart, white labor, and used to be the counterpart to keep people of color, and so whether that's, you know, free labor or slave labor, in line and in control and in some kind of place. So I think that there's this aspect of that history that tends to fall out sometimes of this conversation, but is important as well. Right. I'm not saying that that is more important than anything y'all are talking about, but I think that that piece of U.S. history is a really key part of what makes that notion that the U.S. is always on this forward-moving, you making progress training, right? I think we tend not to look at these really critical moments where people are given an option to keep retaining a certain form of privilege kind of in exchange for something else. So I feel like that also comes to shape these histories in really big ways.
Well, I think all those things make sense in terms of the decline in labor, but also, you know, labor has been very hard hit in manufacturing. All those jobs have left, and so it's really impacted the numbers and the density of labor. But also, while that was going on, too, we have this whole emergence of, you know, white-collar workers and low-skilled white-collar workers who don't see themselves as working class, don't necessarily see themselves as needing to be organized, and don't really have a labor history, too, or a labor tradition, which I think is also a challenge for us moving forward, making tie in between class and unionization, which is helping people to realize that they are part of this working class, even though they may be wearing white collar instead of a blue collar for their job. So.
But I think that's part of our challenge, right? Like to sort of that's part of consciousness raising, right? Collective consciousness raising and part of the long term sustained struggle, right? Is of any kind possible.
Well, I know, for example, in our program, which is primarily the electricians, like I said, which is obviously primarily male and a very small percentage of women. And the question is, why aren't there more women in the trades? And it's the men in the group, why is that so? They'll just say, well, because they don't want to be. You know, it's dirty work, and et cetera. So along the lines that you're talking about, in order, you know, what kinds of questions, what kinds of activities, what kinds of readings do you do to go beneath that and see sort of, you know, some of the theoretical underpinnings of why, in fact, that would be so. Clearly not just choice.
And also bringing race into that conversation, right, and how they're, even when they're students of color sitting in the classroom, they'll be incredibly racist and fed. But then there's a sort of entire kind of dichotomy in children of thinking where, well, you know, my brother sort of is different. He doesn't do that with me, right? But there's a white student and a black student, and the white student may say something incredibly racist, and he'll turn to the black student and say that, you know, well, my brother here isn't like, he's different, right? And so then, where do you, right? Like that sort of. So there are all these open spaces of opportunities, I think, for. And that's problem putting. Right? So asking questions on our kind of different.
Maybe this should be our last forum. I hope you met.
Thank you.
Well, I hope you agree that this is a good
question.
Thank you.